Welcome to RISE, Radio Internet Story Exchange, a weekly public affairs program helping you to ask questions, find answers, and distinguish the truth from the lie. I'm Kelia Ramirez. Today's program is Fox Guarding the Hen House, Henry Kissinger and the Unanswered Questions of 9/11. You may want to keep a paper and pencil handy, as we'll be giving out a lot of addresses today. On the day before Thanksgiving, when news services throughout the country were focused on feel-good stories about feeding the poor, what we have to be thankful for, and what the prospects are for a successful Christmas shopping season, George W. Bush named Henry Kissinger to head a so-called independent commission investigating 9/11. Despite his alleged prestige as the winner of a Nobel Peace Prize, a quick search of Google News headlines shows that Kissinger is not a popular choice. The Boston Globe: some see Kissinger as wrong man for the job. The Rocky Mountain News: not Kissinger again. The Salt Lake Tribune: a poor choice. The Moscow Times in Russia: Kissinger is back in an ugly deja vu. The Daily Times of Pakistan: Kissinger's unfit past. And scoop.co.nz in New Zealand: Kissinger, the wrong man for all seasons. 2 days after the appointment, the New York Times said in an unsigned editorial, quote, "In naming Henry Kissinger to direct a comprehensive examination of the government's failure to prevent the September 11th attacks, President Bush has selected a consummate Washington insider. Mr. Kissinger obviously has a keen intellect and vast experience in national security matters. Unfortunately, his affinity for power and the commercial interests he has cultivated since leaving government may make him less than the staunchly independent figure that is needed for this critical post. Indeed, it is tempting to wonder if the choice of Mr. Kissinger is not a clever maneuver by the White House to contain an investigation it long opposed." Unquote. While David Korn, The Nation magazine's Washington editor, is no friend of RISE's editorial position that the U.S. government knew the 9/11 attacks were going to occur and let them happen, we happily recommend his article on workingforchange.com titled, "The Gold Standard of Badness. Maybe Osama would be a worse choice to head a 9/11 probe. Maybe." It gives a good summary of Kissinger's history. And by any honest reckoning, Henry Kissinger is a war criminal. So does that qualify him to lead a commission investigating a crime against humanity on the theory of takes one to know one? In a recent Slate.com article, Christopher Hitchens, author of the book The Trial of Henry Kissinger, bluntly asked, quote, "Why is a proven liar and wanted man in charge of the 9/11 investigation?" Rice thinks there's only one answer: to facilitate a cover-up. Despite Kissinger's claim that the commission would go wherever the facts lead, we can be sure that there will be certain issues it won't go near, issues that can put the current pseudo-administration and its clients in politically damning and perhaps even criminal light. Today we look at some of the unanswered questions of 9/11, questions we think that the National Commission on Terrorist Attacks Upon the United States, or the Kissinger Commission as it's bound to be called, is going to leave unanswered. Most of what you are about to hear are excerpts from a press conference held at the National Press Club in Washington, D.C. on June 10, 2002. The conference marked the launching of the website unansweredquestions.org, an online community of concerned citizens, researchers, independent investigators, and journalists. UnansweredQuestions.org is one of many websites and publications whose publishers, contributors, and readers won't take "we had no warnings." We had no idea planes could be used as weapons. We had some warnings, but they were too general. We had some warnings, but the information was mishandled. And it was a failure of intelligence, as explanations for 9/11. And they, and we at RISE, won't accept the results of the Kissinger Commission as any kind of last word on the subject of 9/11.
Welcome to the press event to launch unansweredquestions.org. My name is Catherine Austin Fitz. I'm going to be the moderator today. We've started to get an incredible flow of questions through the internet, and I wanted to ask Kyle to come up and walk through some of the ones we've gotten, because already it's amazing when you realize that there are researchers all over the world who are working together and collaborating to try and understand not only what happened on 9/11, but to understand the response and to try and get some of these questions answered. So without further ado, let me introduce Kyle Hens, who is a sailor in Rhode Island.
Thank you very much, Catherine. I've been concerned as a citizen of this country about a sense of oppression. It's like, I feel that being here, I'm exercising my freedom to ask these questions. And it's been quite astounding, the flow of questions just in the past few weeks from those who are also asking questions. I've gotten emails from Czechoslovakia, Australia, the other side of the world, and some are general and some are extraordinarily detailed with copious references. Some are complex, others are just straightforward. But what knights them all is a deep underlying skepticism by those who pose them about the official story offered us of what happened on September 11th, and they hunger to know the whole truth. They cover issues ranging from highly unusual trading spikes of put options prior to September 11th, to airline security failures, to the failure of air defenses in defending the Pentagon and the World Trade Center. Some wonder whatever happened to the anthrax investigation. Did we receive detailed warnings from overseas as reported in mainstream press? If so, who received them and what was done? I'll just read a few. People can pose questions and then vote on the questions that come through. Now, 134 people want to have this question answered. Who are the investors and individual stockbrokers that placed abnormally high bets, put options, just before 9/11 on American Airlines and United Airlines stock? Of the companies and individuals who are involved in the brokering, financing, construction, and use of the Trans-Afghani Unocal pipeline, which were party to secret U.S. energy policy meetings with Vice President Dick Cheney? 82 people want to have that question answered. Is President George Herbert Walker Bush's advisory role in the private defense contractor Carlyle Group and close business ties with the Bin Laden family endangering American lives? After George W. Bush was first informed about the crisis in New York around 9 a.m., why did he not immediately make a change in his schedule and begin direct consultations with the NMCC, national security members, and give the authorization to take defensive action? After the NMCC crisis action team was set up at 8:50 a.m., knowing that one hijacked plane had crashed into the World Trade Center and that another hijacked plane was within 50 miles of New York City, why did the NMCC not declare a state of emergency and order as many fighters as possible into the air? A question that occurred to me when I did my own analysis of the official NORAD press release is, why did the planes fly at subsonic speeds when we had four hijacked planes? Those were planes, two planes reportedly that scrambled from Otis Air Force Base and two from Langley. And why did they scramble planes from Langley, 140 miles away, when you have ready squadrons available at Andrews Air Force Base here? So I hope that gives you a flavor of some of those questions that are coming forth. I don't know who's asking them, but those are some questions that I've also wondered about myself. And I think there are a lot of Americans out there who would like answers. Thank you very much.
Mary Schiavo is an attorney at Braun, Bedlin, Aristel, Gifford, and Schiavo in Los Angeles. She is an attorney for 32 passenger families from the 9/11 plane. She's a former assistant U.S. attorney and the former inspector general at the Department of Transportation and is the author of Flying Blind and Flying Safe. Mary Schiavo?
Well, the important question to ask, and I knew this immediately because I know that a lot of you think that in the days following 9/11 that the carriers got together and figured out that they needed to do something to protect themselves from the obvious facts that would come out and from the liability that would ensue therefrom. And so like you, I thought that they probably did that in a respectable time frame following 9/11. But from my rounds on the Hill to find these facts and others, I learned that the airlines approached members of Congress and the Senate to get their bailout and their immunity and their protection starting on 9/11. They sent their first lobbyists up to the Hill on 9/11. And this has been confirmed to me personally by senators and members of Congress. Now, to me, that's very shocking. But to me, it raises another question. Why? Why do they have to rush to the Hill to change the law, laws which are all sworn to uphold, laws which we are supposed to defend and protect, laws which we now say 9/11 is about to bring the world in line with the rule of law and justice. Well, I'll tell you why. Because on a September day, four planes were hijacked in Islamic Jihad. It shocked the world and would forever change the law under which we act. It would set new laws, it would change the world as we knew it, and it should have forever changed the world of aviation. You think I'm talking about September 11. I'm not. I'm talking about September 12, 1970. Yes, we had an Islamic Jihad. Four airplanes were hijacked. Actually, it was supposed to be five. They were taken to Jordan. They were blown up on September 12, 1970. The laws were dramatically changed. The interesting thing is that one of the airlines involved rushed to court, Pan Am. Not to say, whoa, hijacking is unforeseen, terrorism and sabotage. Who would have known? Who could have suspected? Who would have ever thought this could happen to us? No one. No. Pan Am went to court to say, of course a hijacking and terrorism against an airline is foreseen and foreseeable. And of course our insurance protects against it. Why? Because we know that aviation is an industry which criminals go after, terrorists seek, and hijackers prey upon to make their political statements in the world. We know this. The date was 1970. So in the wake of September 11, 2001, when we heard carriers and governments alike saying, oh, no one could have foreseen this, no one knew that this was coming, no one knew that there were any risks like this in the world, is absolutely false. And we knew that before Condoleezza Rice made the shocking announcements about not only was there a great amount of information known, but that the carriers and the FAA were warned repeatedly. In fact, in that very speech, the admission was that they were warned at least five times, including specifically, I love this language, that it wasn't a specific warning. Let me tell you, Middle Eastern terrorists hell-bent on a hijacking is pretty darn specific. And in fact, there are cases in law in the history of aviation history that said, and airlines are responsible for that, whether or not they follow the law, they should have, if necessary, even hired armed personnel to guard their passengers. Why? Because passengers had a contract. And in addition here, of course, you had a horrible, horrible tragedy on the ground as well. Let me give you a little, for instance, of what was known out there in the aviation industry. I am personally looking at every single terrorist attack and hijacking against modern aviation. And I even gave the carriers a break. I didn't start in 1970 with the big four airplane Islamic Jihad. I started 30 years ago from September 11, 1972. In the last 30 years, we have had 682 hijackings. 682. Here's an interesting statistic. When we had the United States saying, oh, we couldn't have known this, and even when passengers were getting calls out to their family, what information went back to them? Guess what? Of those 682 hijackings in the last 30 years, 101 times passengers fought to defend themselves and took down the hijackers, including, of course, El Al, which successfully foiled the hijacking on September 12, 1970, in the original four-plane Islamic Jihad. How many bombings do you suppose there have been? That's what we say we were busy looking for on September 11. They said, well, we were looking for bombers. We were still looking for Pan Am 103. Well, we had 682 hijackings. We had 31 bombings. How about shootdowns? We think that's even rarer. 59. So the thing that we were all out there searching for, the Pan Am 103 bomber, among hijackings, shootdowns, and bombings, was actually the least number of things that we had suffered. How about other unanswered questions from the aviation industry? What about the specific warnings? Hijacking, Middle Eastern, going to seek to attack aviation is pretty specific. We now, of course, know from subsequent revelations that indeed this was being planned as early as 1995. But there are many, many more questions. What about the Federal Aviation Security Regulations, which were violated? Both the carriers involved here had record numbers of violations in 98, 99, and 2000. What are they? Well, everybody seems to be hiding behind national security. How about those airliner doors? I think in the end we will find that the doors were open. But we are now asking questions about how do we secure them? What about the fact they're open with the same key? What about this profiling system? A profiling system which largely consists of asking you if you packed your own bags, if you bought a one-way ticket, if you used a credit card, or if you used cash, and on that day, and I happen to represent some passengers who were profiled with some of the hijackers, that meant that they waited to see if you got on the plane before they put your bag on. That was our security. Remember, we'd had 682 hijackings, but 31 bombings, and our security was intent to see if you got on the plane before your bag went on. Flight schools. Just now we're looking at flight schools. Airport screening contractors. Abominably incompetent, the Federal Aviation Administration was told to certify and screen the screeners by Congress. They did not do it. I think we need to know why. Airports themselves had the same security contractors lack security, by the way. They're well represented by former government officials, too, by the way, who are out doing spin control saying how great the security was. We need to know what happened to the airport security and what was their success and failure rates. By the way, those are now said to be national security secrets. Jump seat privileges, what happened to those? Targets of terrorism of other airlines and airplanes in the past, those got investigations. This didn't. Why is this now impossible for anyone to ask a reasonable question about? What about the information from the air traffic control? They had information that happened in the beginning, and yet no warnings were given to the pilots about specific events that were going on or of warnings of don't open the door, what's going on, don't open that door under any circumstances. Already there's a federal aviation regulation about not opening the door. We need to know why. Why didn't that information go out? Thank you.
Any questions?
Thank you. My name is Daryl Bodley, and my daughter was on Flight 93, which crashed in Pennsylvania. And I appreciate the courage that you have to be on the panel today. I'm glad that you're here and making these statements. My biggest unanswered question today, in light of the information which has been recently uncovered, is this. Did my daughter, my 20-year-old daughter, my only child, have to die on September 11th for the sake of the well-being of the American civil aviation system? I have a big question in my mind whenever government officials denigrate the value of human life and well-being when comparing it to the value of a system. Yet this is exactly the comparison that was made by Condoleezza Rice in a press conference on May 16th when she said, "You would have risked shutting down the American civil aviation system with such generalized information," referring to general threats which had been increasing in number during the summer of 2001. Ms. Rice did not acknowledge that, according to recent articles in Time magazine, U.S. intelligence analysts had received specific information that terrorists had discussed using jetliners in exactly the type of suicide attacks carried out in New York and Washington on September 11th. My question is, was Ms. Rice unaware of this when she said in the same press conference on May 16th, "I don't think that anybody could have predicted that these people would take an airplane and slam it into the World Trade Center, take another one and slam it into the Pentagon." If the terrorists had envisioned it, and the U.S. government knew that they had envisioned it, why didn't our U.S. intelligence community, including the NSA, envision it and compel the civil aviation system, the airlines and the airports, to protect us, to keep my daughter from dying on September 11th?
You are listening to RISE, Radio Internet Story Exchange.
Michael Rupert, the publisher of From the Wilderness, who's going to be speaking to us from Canada. Mike has been one of the leaders in trying to collect up and promote all the indications that the administration and the American government did have prior knowledge and some of the anomalies and inconsistencies in the story. Mike's a former LAPD narcotics officer who's done a great deal of illumination of sort of official stories of many issues, including narcotics trafficking.
The Bush administration must be forced to admit that they knew hijacked planes were going to be used as weapons. Why else would terrorists take flight training lessons? You can't crop dust with a 757 that you don't know how to land or even take off. Why else would the G8 conference in Genoa less than a year earlier have had extensive preparations to prevent hijacked aircraft from being used as weapons? President Bush was there, surrounded by anti-aircraft weapons. Was he not briefed on it? Just a few of the questions that must be answered are going to be discussed today, and we have now been asking them at From the Wilderness since September the 12th. Now many more people are asking, why did the U.S. State Department officials, Carl Linderfurth, Tom Simmons, and Lee Coldren, travel to Berlin in July 2001 to tell the Taliban that the U.S. government was going to, quote, bury them in a carpet of bombs in October 2001. Why were no fighters scrambled for 50 minutes after the first two planes had hit the World Trade Center? Why did Andrews Air Force Base alter its website on 9/13 to hide the fact that it had scramble-ready fighters? Why were massive numbers of U.S., British, and NATO forces pre-positioned off the Pakistani coast in Oman and Egypt before the 9/11 attacks? Why has no one forcefully demanded an explanation from the administration as to why the head of the Pakistani intelligence service, the ISI, wired $100,000 to Mohammed Atta before the attacks and then was happily in Washington, D.C. meeting with the heads of the House and Senate intelligence committees on September the 11th? Why has the Wall Street Journal or any other major paper not investigated the fact that the aide of the head of the ISI who wired the money to Atta, Ahmad Umar Sheikh, is also the lead suspect in the murder of reporter Daniel Pearl? Why did the National Security Council convene a Dobhole working group in the summer of 2001 to help a beleaguered Enron try to find a way to salvage a $3 billion investment in a power-generating station that could only operate if there was a natural gas pipeline across Afghanistan? Why has John Ashcroft not recused himself from two sitting federal grand juries looking at ExxonMobil and BP Amoco's frantic and desperate attempts to get oil out of Central Asia when those two companies donated more money to Ashcroft when he was a senator than Enron did? Why has the White House broken laws to hide the records of the Vice President's Energy Task Force when targets of grand jury probes looking at Kazakh oil corruption, Exxon and BP Amoco, were granted access? That's the same thing as having Manuel Noriega advise the White House in the war on drugs. Is it because the Vice President himself, Dick Cheney, was a sitting member of the Kazakh government's oil advisory board when the bribes were given and the oil swap completed? Why has the government not disclosed the results of the massive insider trading on the financial markets before September the 11th? Why has no one told the American people about the results of the put options that were placed on UAL through a firm, Alex Brown Deutsche Bank, that was headed until 1998 by the man who is now the executive director of the CIA, A.B. Buzzy Krongard? And what about the drugs? The Taliban destroyed their opium crop. In January of 2001, there was virtually none in the country. And yet the world's largest harvest of opium poppies is taking place right now, all planted, since the U.S. government and the CIA took control of the country. The public is rightfully skeptical about a White House that has lied to them about the events of September the 11th. Unmitigated and fearless accountability is the standard for all of us today, and I can assure you that as far as September 11th goes, time is on our side, and this government knows it. Thank you, and God bless all of you.
You are listening to RISE, Radio Internet Story Exchange. I'm Kelia Ramirez. Recently, RISE called Mike Rupert to get his reaction to the appointment of Henry Kissinger to chair the 9/11 Commission.
You know, I'm still so stunned by the news that I don't have words for it, not even cuss words. It feels like Kissinger's selection is something out of left field, or shall I say right field. What's your reaction to it?
Well, I think that there's going to be a very sizable reaction and protest to the Kissinger appointment, leaving one of two options, one of which is that the administration will just put him there and basically ignore the cries of the American people saying that this is an obvious conflict of interest and an obvious dishonest attempt to cover up the truth of 9/11. On the other hand, I see perhaps the move as a way to subsequently withdraw Kissinger and to place George Mitchell in charge of the commission, who is really not much better. George Mitchell was Army intelligence in Germany right after World War II, who helped bring Nazis back to the U.S. He sits on the board of many major corporations, and he's been a part of many cover-ups as well. And I think that, possibly they could bring up Kissinger, have everybody get upset about it, which is clearly happening, and then withdraw Kissinger and have everybody breathe a sigh of relief, only to have the same end result with George Mitchell in charge.
Do you think enough people know about Kissinger's war criminal history to really make enough fuss?
I think there's a decent sense of it. As I watch many news reports now, I'm seeing, even mainstream news start to raise questions about Kissinger, which is probably a job that he really wouldn't want anyway, because it will put him under the spotlight. And if his background, if his long list of war crimes from Vietnam, from Chile, from 100 places isn't an issue now, it will be during the course of the commission. And every moment that he's in the public spotlight on the commission, he runs that risk. So I think they're concerned about the skeletons in Kissinger's closet. Europe will certainly make very big bones about it.
Do you think that this commission is going to be any good for those of us who are really trying to tell the truth?
I have never once since 9/11 had any faith in any presidentially appointed independent commission. I hearken back to all the commissions that we've had that have been nothing but cover-ups, starting with the Warren Commission. Why would it be any different now? It's absolute foolishness and complete naivete to expect any revelation of truth out of a body like this.
Is there any hay the independent researchers can make from it anyway?
Well, I'm sure that we will make whatever lemonade is possible out of the lemons, but this is a far cry from being any substantive progress in getting a full political disclosure of what happened on 9/11 and addressing the things which brought it. You know, we would be satisfying ourselves with crumbs from the table to investigate and research the little anomalies and the little bits that are disclosed, which would have some effect in the research community, maybe some small effect in the activist community, but it'll have no effect in the larger populace of the country.
Mike, you've been doing a lot of lecturing across the country in Canada, Australia. Are the people getting it that this government, at minimum, knew 9/11 was coming and let it happen, and maybe more?
Oh, I think very much the people are. Many of the people who have been active on this, like myself, Nafiz Ahmed, Michel Chosudovsky, and a great many others are still seeing, we're seeing increasing interest, as a matter of fact, as things get worse at home, especially since the passage of Homeland Security, the very obvious flaws with the 2002 midterm elections, and this juggernaut toward an inevitable invasion of Iraq and, I believe, occupation of Saudi Arabia. People are starting to wake up slowly, and there's a great many people out there who are asking questions. So I don't think that's gone away. But for every step that the American people collectively take toward a full consciousness of the seriousness of what's happening, the government seems to be taking two steps to remain in front of them.
Do you think that Bush might have made a mistake yesterday by slashing the raises of federal workers on the grounds that we have to afford the war on terrorism?
Well, this is part of the arrogance of the administration. I think it was definitely a political mistake. But I think it also reflects the deeper underlying economic fragility of the U.S. economy, the U.S. Treasury, the budget, and very serious problems that are looming on the horizon with energy shortages, especially in natural gas and oil, that are going to be very devastating to the U.S. economy. One thing that I will say post 9/11 is that the world did effectively, for some period of time, delay Bush's plans to invade Iraq. I have no doubt, based upon troop deployments that took place last summer, that he had intended to invade Iraq last September or October. Now we will not see it probably until December or January. It is still inevitable. But having slowed the U.S. timetable down by a period of about, 5 months or so, I think the economic issues are getting worse, and Bush is having to look at some of those. But I think that was a very stupid mistake politically.
As you said, arrogant, and is that appointment of Kissinger an act of arrogance as well?
Arrogance, stupidity, but also probably a statement of, I think arrogance sums it up. I mean, it's, hey, we're in control, we've got it, and you'll buy what we tell you to buy. I don't think the American people will lay still for Kissinger, certainly not through the duration, the 18-month duration of the commission. But, you know, I am still very suspicious that it's a 1-2 punch to withdraw Kissinger and put Mitchell firmly in place, who will do exactly what Bush wants anyway.
The timeline of this commission's responsibilities is rather interesting. They're supposed to take a few months to get set up. Then they've got 18 months to do the report. That takes them to right around the election in 2004, doesn't it?
Yes, it does.
You think they come out with it before or after the election?
Oh, I'm sure that they will probably come out with it before. That's their plan, although the way I see world events shaping up, I don't know that we're going to be able to recognize the world by the next presidential election. There's going to be a great many changes in the economy, in the way we live our lives, with the war, with casualties. But I think certainly by that time, be very obvious signs of a peak energy crisis, shortages of oil and natural gas that are starting to have devastating effects.
Anything else?
No, I think that I am as shocked as anybody else at how rapidly this empire is moving forward with an agenda, seemingly not even distracted by the activism that has taken place in this country. And I guess a part of me is thinking that insanity is repeating the same action, expecting different results. I think very much those of us who are activists need to look for different tactics to derail this thing other than what we have been doing in the past. And we have to be very, very oriented totally on results and performance rather than what feels good.
That was Michael C. Rupert, publisher and editor of From the Wilderness. He's currently writing a book called Crossing the Rubicon, America's Descent into Fascism at the End of the Age of Oil. It will be published in spring 2003 by Farrell House. Rupert's website is www.copvcia.com. That's www.copvcia.com. We now continue with excerpts of the press conference on the unanswered questions of 9/11.
Mike Springman. Mike has 20 years of government and foreign service, including he's an attorney. He was the former chief of the visa section for a consulate in Saudi Arabia. And he's going to speak as to CIA and global terrorism.
As Catherine mentioned, I used to be in charge of the visa section at the CIA's consulate at Jeddah, the principal city of the Hejaz in western Saudi Arabia. There, for a year and a half, I issued visas to terrorists recruited by the CIA and its asset, Osama bin Laden. At the time, I thought it was basically visa fraud. Somebody was paying $2,500 bribes to State Department officials. I was ordered by these same high State Department officials to issue the visas, to shut up, to do my job, and ask no questions. And this wasn't simply a difference of opinion, as was alleged later on. It wasn't one of these things where they wanted to visit their father in America, there was a question of where they worked, that sort of thing. It was basically two Pakistanis came to me one day and said, we want to go to a trade show in America. And I asked, what's the trade show? They didn't know. What city is it going to be held in? They didn't know. And I asked a few more questions, and I said, no, visa denied. You haven't proved to me that you're going to come to the United States, accomplish your business, and then return home. Well, a few minutes later, I had a phone call from a CIA case officer assigned to the commercial section. Issue the visas. And I said, no. And he said, well, it's important they get a visa. And I said, no. And a few minutes later, he was over talking to the chief of the consular section. Reversed me, issued the visas, and these guys took off. And this was typical. I had a Sudanese who was unemployed in Saudi Arabia. He was a refugee from the Sudan. And I said, you don't get a visa. And he kept coming back and coming back and coming back. And after a bit, I started getting calls from a woman I believe was a case officer who was in the political section. We need this guy. And I said, no. He hasn't proved to me that he's going to America and he's going to come back, as the Immigration and Nationality Act says, and as the State Department's Foreign Affairs Manual says. Well, short order, I got reversed again, and he got his visa for national security reasons. And this went on for a year and a half. I had people, not every day perhaps, but every week. And as many as 100 people got visas through me getting overruled on my analysis of their ability to go to the United States in return. And I protested this. I protested to the Counselor for Consular Affairs in Riyadh. I protested to the Bureau of Consular Affairs in Washington. I protested to the State Department's Inspector General. I protested to the State Department's Office of Diplomatic Security. I talked about this to the FBI, to the Justice Department's Office of Professional Responsibility, and I went to a couple of congressional committees. And by and large, I was told, shut up. You don't know what you're talking about. This is a difference of opinion. You don't know what you're doing. You're far too junior to question the consul general in Jeddah's interest in doing this. He's a guy that was seen sitting in his office filling out visa application forms for Pakistanis with forged passports. He wanted visas for Libyans who had no ties to our consular district whatsoever. And I came back to Washington after a trip to Germany, and I was assigned to the Bureau of Intelligence and Research in the State Department. And eventually my appointment was canceled. After this, and after I tried mightily for several years to find out what had happened to me, and the Freedom of Information Act requests were being stonewalled on the basis of national security, I ran across the journalist Joe Trento, and about the same time, I ran across two people, one of whom was a government official, and another one was a person attached to a local university here in Washington. All three confirmed that what I was protesting was not visa fraud, but people being rounded up by the agency and Osama bin Laden to come to the United States for training as terrorists to be sent to fight in the war against the then Soviet Union in Afghanistan. They used roughly $1 million in liquor sales a year from the consulate in Jeddah to fund this. And you might ask, well, as the Washington Legal Times did, that was then. This is now, 15 years later. Well, from what I read in the Los Angeles Times, 15 of the 19 people who allegedly flew airplanes into buildings in the United States got their visas from the same CIA consulate at Jeddah. And according to a journalist in Florida, Sidney Friedberg, a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist, they got this through the Visa Express program where you handed in your documents and they packed them off in a bunch of other documents, people traveling to the States for a legitimate reason with a legitimate travel agency. Well, Celerino Castillo, the former DEA officer, told me this was common practice for the CIA in Central America. They put their guys in, hoping that the paperwork would be overlooked, that they wouldn't get too many questions asked. And when I raised this with the Los Angeles Times, with the New York Times, with the Washington Post, with 60 Minutes, nobody wanted to talk about it. But Covert Action Quarterly printed my article on the hand that rules the visa machine rocks the world. Unclassified, the Journal of the Association of National Security Alumni printed a couple of articles I had done on the links between the State Department and the CIA. The agency assigns its people to virtually every section of every consulate and diplomatic post in the world. They routinely troll visa applications. They look to see who's coming to America, either to recruit them or to find out how they can get next to them and get some information from them, or to steer them for their own purposes. But in Europe, in Canada, other people are interested in this. I was interviewed by Greg Palast of the BBC, and I was interviewed by the Canadian Broadcasting Company here in this building. The Italian radio and television service, RAI, interviewed me by telephone. I've had a couple of interviews on the radio with Pacifica. Greg Palast and I were on Friday morning. I've been interviewed on a couple of other radio programs scattered through the Midwest and West, but nobody in Washington, D.C. wants to hear about this. Nobody in Washington, D.C. wants to hear about the CIA and its assigning case officers to the consular section. There was a guy in with me who'd say, when there's a line of people in front of us, "Mike, let me take this guy in line. He's one of my people." So I really think the organization Unanswered Questions has a lot of questions to ask, and it deserves answers to them from the government. Thank you for the opportunity to talk.
This is RISE, Radio Internet Story Exchange. I'm Kelia Ramirez. To question the official accounts of 9/11 is to subject yourself to being called unpatriotic, a nutball conspiracy theorist, or worse. Earlier this year, when Georgia Congresswoman Cynthia McKinney called for an investigation into 9/11 and questioned whether former President George Herbert Walker Bush and his friends at the Carlyle Group were profiting from the war on Afghanistan, White House Press Secretary Ari Fleischer said, quote, "She must be running for the Hall of Fame of the Grassy Knoll Society." One person who would qualify for such a hall is John Judge, a founder and former executive director of COPA, the Coalition on Presidential Assassinations. COPA's efforts have led to the disclosure of millions of pages of data on the assassination of John F. Kennedy. Rise asked him for his reaction to the appointment of Henry Kissinger, and not surprisingly, he saw parallels between the 9/11 Commission and the Warren Commission that investigated JFK's murder. Henry Kissinger was appointed to head the 9/11 Commission. What was your first thought?
Well, my first thought was just, they couldn't have picked a more appropriate candidate in one sense. I mean, from our point of view, but inappropriate in terms of doing the investigation. I think Kissinger has a reputation so low that it couldn't be tarnished by being part of a cover-up commission on 9/11. And even though the press and the pundits and the establishment still try to hold him in high regard, I remember Harold Pinter's comment, the British satirist, who said that after they awarded Kissinger the Nobel Peace Prize, he put down his pen because he couldn't say anything more satirical than that. Here's this guy that carried on the genocide and ecocide and ethnocide of the Vietnam War without a conscience. He was part of the circle around Nixon during the whole Watergate operation. He headed up the Kissinger Commission to cover up CIA misdeeds and did, you know, basically looking at your own naval investigation of the CIA, since he was certainly part and parcel of interventions in Central and South America and Chile and elsewhere. He's currently being sued by Rene Schneider's family, a person who was murdered in Chile as part of the coup that he helped engineer. And that suit was mentioned on September 10th last year and then disappeared from the news with the 9/11. He can't go abroad without being threatened with subpoenas and testimony trial for his war crimes abroad. Much of this has been documented, and you know, he's somebody that still sits at the top levels of the establishment and has credibility with them, but not with anybody that has any real sense of history. So, I mean, Earl Warren had a better reputation, at least before he went into the Warren Commission, and they put up somebody that people could trust. But to put up Kissinger, who almost nobody trusts, is a slap in the face of the American public. And like I said, I guess you couldn't get anybody else to do it, because who'd want to put their name to this phony report?
How does him being the chairman help those of us who are investigating the truth about 9/11?
Well, Vincent Solandri, one of the early critics of the Warren Commission, has said that he favored a congressional or governmental commission on 9/11, not because he felt it would get at the truth. He knew it would be designed not to, but because it would give us the fodder or the information, as the Warren Commission report did, to deconstruct that and show the lie for the American people. And so in that sense, Kissinger is a benefit to us, because we already have somebody who's not trusted leading this investigation, and how he leads it and how he frames it, which is already constricted to knowing what the terrorists actually did and how to prevent it in the future. And that's the frame that they want to put this in. Of course, if you really historically answer that question, you'd have to think that these terrorists are so clever that they got the CIA to support them, arm them, and train them for years and years just in order to be able to do this, and had money coming through those same conduits that the CIA used to fund them right up to the time of the incident, and that they were clever enough somehow to dismantle the normal defense mechanisms of the whole United States on 9/11 in order to carry out what they did. So how the terrorists did it would have to be answered in part as how did we let them do it. But I'm sure that's not where Kissinger's going to go with it. And it's going to be used to try to twist it around into saying that we need more money for defense or more money for human intelligence, other kinds of intelligence operations, and more consolidation of information and you know, more repression and spying on civilians and the whole bag. But if you really honestly answer the question, how did the terrorists get away with this, the United States has to be part of that answer.
Do you think there should be any kind of move or public pressure to get him off the commission?
Well, I don't think there's anything wrong with critiquing him at this point and showing people what the contradictions are of all, whether it would have any influence on Bush, who appointed him. I mean, I don't know that he has to be authorized by the Congress or the Senate for this position. I don't know if that's the case. If so, it certainly would be worth trying to get members of Congress to raise questions about it. But as we know, this is a Congress that at one point was getting calls and faxes and emails at the rate of 400 to 1,000 to 1 opposed to the resolution authorizing the Gulf War, and yet the majority of the Congress voted for it. So they're not a Congress that's responsive or democratic or representative. But to the extent that they might play a role in this, they could challenge it, even if they aren't technically allowed to decide. They certainly could raise questions about it, as the public should, to try to show what credibility it lacks right from the beginning. And if people had really known Earl Warren's background at the time that he was put in, rather than the public mythology that was around him, I think they would have complained about that too. They certainly should have complained about the appointment of Alan Dulles, a former head of the CIA fired by Kennedy, John J. McCloy, a Rockefeller banking lawyer and top-level person in the establishment in the corporate world, who had a long past of being a neo-fascist and proto-fascist here in the United States, and helped with, as Earl Warren did, with the creation of the Japanese concentration camps in California, and also as High Commissioner of Germany. McCloy pardoned key Nazis after the war that had been convicted of war crimes. And Kissinger's right on that cusp himself, and they've finally admitted that the main reason they don't want to join the international criminal courts or be part of international law structures is that people like Kissinger would be up for grabs by those entities. So I think he's worth exposing.
My understanding, families of the victims were engaged in some sort of negotiation over the structure of the commission.
Yeah, the families have played a role, and in fact, it was family pressure in meetings in the White House with Bush that really pushed him over the edge. He had been blocking having any investigation whatsoever. They know that the families have tremendous political pressure and strength, you know, with them. So they were coming in there sort of like a freight train, and they pushed Bush to do this investigation. So if the families raised a stink about Kissinger being the person appointed, that could also have an effect, because they have tremendous power as the families, and they would, you know, they would resonate with the American public in the same way that Bobby Kennedy, had he thought through and had that as his agenda, could have created a populist movement by just saying that someone has killed my brother and we don't know who and I want the thing investigated in 1964. If he had said that, the whole American public would have gone with him. And similarly, if these families stand up and really demand the truth, they can make a big difference in terms of public sentiment about this.
Anything else?
Well, I just think, you know, we're further down the evidentiary path since 9/11. We have some glaring vulnerabilities that still aren't dealt with, especially the apparent military stand-down on that day that allowed the plane to come into the Pentagon, and a lack of response to the hijackings as a whole, or any effective response, even though there were mechanisms in place. The questions raised around the anthrax, which basically was tracked to the gates of Fort Detrick in the military intelligence establishment, at which point no investigation happened for months, and now they're trying to blame a lone wolf. But I think that's pretty disingenuous, and this is not the person that did it. And the fact that they're vulnerable on several other levels in terms of really explaining what happened that day. It wasn't a matter of the intelligence failing on the situation. It was a matter of a policy of non-response that drove John O'Neill out of the FBI earlier on, their top counterterrorism expert, because he was not being allowed to investigate the operations of the terrorists abroad, and he became director instead of the security for the World Trade Center, but he died in the buildings that day. And there's clear indications that attempts to investigate both Saudi Arabia and members of the bin Laden circle in Afghanistan were being frustrated, and that really hasn't been explored, and that's not an intelligence failure, it's a policy decision.
That was assassinations researcher John Judge. More of his comments on 9/11 were featured on the first RISE program, 9/11 and New Wars. It can be found on our website, www.rise4news.net. That's www.rise4news.net. The appointment of Henry Kissinger, Secretary of State and National Security Advisor in the notoriously secretive Nixon administration, to head an investigation of 9/11 is another symptom of the disease of denial, which infects the corporate media as well as the government. C-SPAN declined to cover the unanswered questions press conference last June, even on tape delay. On the eve of the first anniversary of the attacks, RISE spoke with Kyle Hentz, co-founder of unanswered questions.org, about the lack of coverage. You had been hoping C-SPAN was going to cover this, right? Why did you think they might even be interested?
They said that directly to Tom Flacco, who was also a co-founder, and they said, basically, this is very interesting, something we want to consider. You know, no promises were made to us at any point that would be inappropriate for them, but they expressed great interest. They encouraged us to stay in touch with them, to keep them up to date with new developments that might be of interest to them, and we did so.
It's my understanding that they generally do cover events at the National Press Club. Is that true?
Most certainly. If you go to their website, it clearly delineates the preconditions that must be met for an event to be covered by C-SPAN.
And those are what?
That the event should be of interest to the general public, public affairs nature, that it should be of national significance, and part of their mandate is to present both sides or various sides of a particular issue. So if our conference represented a perspective that had not been heard regarding the events of 9/11, then certainly by airing our conference, they would be fulfilling that specific prerequisite for covering events. The fourth prerequisite is the speakers participating should be closely related to the topic under discussion. And in our case, we had Mary Schiavo representing 33 victim family members speaking about her case that she's bringing against the airlines and other agencies of the government.
And you also had Julie Sweeney, who's a 911 widow.
Yes. The fact remains, as far as I know, there has been virtually no coverage that I'm aware of by C-SPAN of the issues that we raised at our June 10th conference at the Press Club in D.C.
What turned things around that they seemed to back off?
Because it was a Monday, they made the decision the week before. Normally, it's like the day before. So they made it on a Friday afternoon, and we were basically standing by the phones, and we didn't hear from them. So we called them. They made no indication as to why it is they did, made the decision that they did. I believe that they felt it was more important to cover the announcements and the events that were having to do with the establishment of Department of Homeland Security. So we were trumped by that news development and some events that the administration was organizing for Monday. Even though there was an extra channel available because the House was off that day, which meant there was an extra channel that normally would be engaged in the proceedings in the House of Representatives.
And would it have been possible for them to do it on a tape delay basis?
Oh, absolutely. There were several options. They could have put it on radio. They could have put it on, you know, C-SPAN 2 live, and they could have come with a team and recorded it. So there were various options. They chose none of them. And as a result of that, we felt that they weren't doing their job. Their edict or their mission is to present balance in terms of issues of major national concern. And what is of more concern than the issues surrounding what happened on September 11th and the aftermath. I've eventually sent them a copy of our tape, you know, of that actual conference. And when I followed up with the vice president of programming there, he said that he hadn't even looked at the video, didn't even want to look at it. I have to say in his defense, though, that we were talking about doing another event in New York, which has been postponed, but he did say, well, keep us in, you know, informed as to developments. They express interest, but in terms of, you know, where the rubber meets the road, they've yet to broach the subject, as most of the media has yet to do.
It would seem to me that by looking at the video, they would have an idea of what you were planning to do further down the road.
Exactly. They could see what we're building upon, and they could see how credible our speakers were and what a strong case they made with regard to what I refer to as the various lines of inquiry that would and should be part of any legitimate investigation into the events of 9/11, leading up to 9/11 and after 9/11. We had CNN come. We had Japanese public television there filming a documentary. We had folks from Vanity Fair. We had about 70 people in the room at the press conference. So there was clearly an opportunity for a story to be told if the inclination was there. Now, CNN never ran a story about the conference. But what happened on that day in terms of news was John Ashcroft, thousands of miles away in Russia, came out and made an announcement about this Padilla, the dirty bomber. And, of course, that became the news that day. And probably, you know, for the next 24-hour, 48-hour news cycle, that was one of the headline news items. And I'm not suggesting that necessarily it's connected with our event, because that would be a stretch. But I thought that it's just an important thing to note. And we all wondered about it, and is this for real? And the timing seems odd, because Padilla had been in custody for some time. And why did they choose that particular time, when Ashcroft was so far away, to come out with this? Well, just a few weeks ago, they made the announcement that Padilla is a nobody. He doesn't have proven ties with al-Qaeda, and he wasn't anywhere near close to having the intelligence or the capability to build a dirty bomb. And so someone who was trumped up as being a great threat to this country, who had been in custody for a considerable amount of time, I heard 30 days, was trumped out on the day of our event, and then, you know, several months later, we find out that he's a nobody. It's very curious, and it begs the question, what are we being played for in this country?
Very curious indeed. Another thing is that I read the transcript, and I noticed that, with the exception of one question from Vanity Fair, that the people who were there who asked questions from the media were from small, little-known media outlets. CNN didn't want to ask a question?
No.
No, they were there taping it, but they did not ask any questions. Yeah, you're correct. Vanity Fair was probably the biggest press outlet that posed a question to our panelists.
Who funds C-SPAN?
C-SPAN is funded by all of the cable providers across the country. There's Liberty, Cox. There's different companies in different areas across the country, and they all pay into the fund or and cover the operational expenses of C-SPAN. I do understand that it was created by Brian Lamb, but it was backed by the cable companies themselves. It was set up to be in a public service, public affairs channel, obviously no advertising and so on, but backed by the cable companies.
That was Kyle Hentz, co-founder of unanswered questions.org. The entire June 10th press conference can be accessed as audio, video, or transcript at www.unanswered questions.org. That's www.unanswered questions.org. You have been listening to RISE, Radio Internet Story Exchange, a weekly public affairs program helping you to ask questions, find answers, and distinguish the truth from the lie. Today's program was Fox Guarding the Hen House, Henry Kissinger and the Unanswered Questions of 9/11. To protest Kissinger's appointment to head the 9/11 Commission, contact the White House. The email address is president@whitehouse.gov. That's president@whitehouse.gov. The mailing address is The White House, 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue Northwest, Washington, D.C., 20500. That's The White House, 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue Northwest, Washington, D.C., 20500. Also contact your members of Congress. You can find out their addresses by going to the websites www.house.gov and www.senate.gov. Again, www.house.gov and www.senate.gov. Write letters to the editor and contact your local broadcast media to demand more coverage of the true independent researchers of 9/11. An extensive list of 9/11 investigative websites is available at the website of the People's Investigation of 9/11 at www.pi911.org. That's www.pi911.org. The numbers 911.org. The website for RISE is www.riseFornews.net. That's RISE, the number 4, news.net. Radio Internet Story Exchange is produced by myself, Kelly O'Ramaris, in part at the studios of radio station KPFA 94.1 FM in Berkeley, California. RISE programs are available on demand at the website. The programs are also webcast on the news stream of Partytown Streaming Network, www.partytown.com/radio. That's www.partytown.com/radio. Radio Internet Story Exchange receives no corporate or foundation funding and depends on you for support. For more information on donating to RISE, receiving or publicizing the program, or giving feedback on programs, please email kellia@riseFornews.net. That's K-E-L-L-I-A at rise, the number 4, news.net. This has been RISE, Radio Internet Story Exchange. Thanks for listening.